Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So, Marlene, we have been brainstorming and setting up interviews for some really great shows coming up over the next few weeks and months. And
lots of calendar sharing.
Lots of calendar sharing this week. So I'm really excited about the variety of guests that we have set up, have agreed to talk to us.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really good set of guests, like today's guest, for example.
Yeah, so we kind of rolled the dice here and asked today's guest to jump on. It's actually the Friday before Memorial Day. We were lucky to reach out and get a hold of him, and he immediately responded, and we got him on like the next day.
I know, unheard of. We'd like to welcome Mike Bomarito, the CEO of 273 Ventures, fellow at Stanford Codex, and about 100 other projects going on in his life. So, Michael, welcome to the Geek in Review.
Thank you for having me, and I guess I have the honor of being the guy who's still around and not on a boat or
but you're in a barn,
already, right?
So but you're in a barn.
That is true, and that's why, in part, I'm available, right, is because this is a weekend when we got to get a lot of stuff in the ground and seeds planted, and I think there's more than a metaphor or two in there for the industry and not just the actual soil here, but more on that, I think, to come.
Yeah. So, Michael, before we dive into all of the latest in generative AI, let's talk a little bit about your work at places like Michigan State University School of Law, Stanford, and Chicago Kent. You've taught courses on legal analytics and other unique data and tech-driven courses. Do you mind telling us about the benefits you get from these collaborations with the academic world? And what do the law students get from courses like this?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one sometimes my wife asks, right, when we're in the middle of a paper and
it.
Paper doesn't pay money, or I'm teaching a class and I'm not going to surprise anybody, but adjunct teaching doesn't exactly pay many bills, if any bills, and so I think the truth is that it is probably a little bit of insanity around learning, right? I mean, to continue to want to learn, especially in light of how much is changing right now, might seem like a crazy desire or Herculean effort, but I think I just love to learn. And the best way to learn is to keep yourself in an environment where you're surrounded by people who also want to learn and where you are forced to distill what is going on around us into something that you can teach. And so that's what teaching is for me, right? It's a way to stay engaged in ideas, to force myself to synthesize and communicate them. And then you obviously learn from students so many different things. They force you to learn and they teach you things. So it's really incomparable, right? In terms of ensuring that we stay with what's happening. And if you like learning, then no better place to do it than in school with students who want to learn too.
Do you have any courses coming up that would be interesting?
Well, I mostly guest lecture these days, right? So I guest lecture in a class that Amani Smathers, a former student from the old reInvent Law days at MSU, teaches. There are, I sometimes guest lecture for the eDiscovery class at MSU too. Both of those areas are kind of the legal process and data and then eDiscovery. Let's just say the syllabus has required some updating in light of the last couple months.
I bet.
But that's an understatement that you have other guests, I'm sure, we'll talk to. And then there's a number of other classes we've kind of taught over the years. Some funnier in retrospect, like the cryptocurrency and blockchain class at Chicago Kent. But we are hoping to put on an LLM-focused, maybe one, maybe two session course at Kent next year. So that's probably the one that I'm most interested in because I think, as we'll get to, it's unlikely that the cohort of 1Ls or 2Ls in school right now will come out into a practice that is absent LLMs day-to-day life, whether it's in back office or kind of front office substantive work, I guess we'll see. But these students who are 1Ls and 2Ls right now, really, we owe it to them for a wide variety of reasons to make sure they know what these tools are, they understand the legal issues, they understand the practical issues, and as educators, what would we be doing if we didn't at least give them the option of learning about this stuff right now? That's the one I really want to make sure we get out there in front of students.
Are you finding that the administration at law schools are, because we're in the large law firm world, and we're kind of jumping through every hoop we can to make sure that we're staying on top of what's going on day after day, which is unusual for us, right? We're usually kind of let's see what the market does.
Sit back and wait.
What are you seeing, or what are the demands that you're seeing from school administrators that are saying we also got to stay on top of this, or do you?
I'd say I dropped out of my PhD a long time ago to work at a hedge fund, and part of that was because I decided I think I didn't really want to do the tenure track thing. So I am luckily and unluckily not tenured, and so therefore don't really have to interface so much with the administrative elements of teaching, which means I just get to teach and interact with students. But from what I do know, I think the elephant in the room, which will probably connect to conversation later, is that the ABA still controls the accreditation guidelines, and you can only deviate so much with a fixed budget and all the other constraints. There's a lot of legacy, and so the problems that have been facing the school administrators are still problems that are still probably larger than whether or not we add a course or two. I'm not really a betting man, but I would bet you in the next couple of years, schools that don't move on LLM curricula will regret it. But right now, they have other fish to fry in terms of, like, what do we do post-COVID? What do we do in light of student lending? What do we do in light of LSAT trends? So they're not the only ones barking at the moon here, I guess you could say.
So now we got to leave it in.
Well done. So,
I have a rooster in the background, so I'm just hoping the rooster doesn't come
to talk to us. He comes to talk to us. Yeah. We've never had a rooster on the show.
Does a rooster have a name?
His name is Foggy.
Foggy.
Foghorn Leghorn.
I do say that is correct, sir.
But listen to me when I'm talking, son.
After the senator, right? I mean, he was a senator. I think he was a state Supreme Court justice prior to his time in the Senate.
Oh, so, anyways,
this is not here.
Fun facts here on the Geek and Review.
Well, speaking of fun facts, let's jump into the big topic, which is the discussion of GPT and the bar exam. So you were heavily involved in both the 3.5 and the GPT-4 versions taking the bar exam. I think it was you and Dan Katz and some others.
Yep.
And
the CPA exam.
Don't forget the CPA exam.
And Lex Kluge.
Right. Don't leave out the accounts.
I think that's that. I know. I mean, this is like, there's so much to talk about this stuff, right? So we have been tracking, I think, at a high level, what can a systematized process of thinking, that's a really vague way of saying, like, let's just say large language models or generative AI, do when presented with legal language for a while. So a couple of years ago, we published a paper called Lex NLP, kind of old school NLP. About a year and a half ago, we published a paper called Lex Glue with a big group of people. The glue is a reference to something else that people in academia have done that's about general language understanding and evaluation. So kind of what will these models do if you ask them a bunch of basic facts, if you ask them about arithmetic problems, the kind of stuff that might be on the LSAT. And over the last, say, 3 to 5 years, there's been a steady but still disappointing trend of marginal improvements, maybe a little bit of a jump. And the things would get better at, let's say, regurgitating material from Wikipedia, but they wouldn't really demonstrate much creativity or spark or ingenuity or complex reasoning. And then clearly that all changed. So like, I've been using large language models one way or another in neural networks broadly for 20 years, I guess, in the latter case, and let's say 3 to 5 years in the former case. GPT-2 was nothing to write home about. Mm. It could write a really bad blog post. It would struggle to write a LinkedIn post, although I guess the standard on that is fairly low these days. Then all of a sudden, Text DaVinci 3, which is kind of GPT-3, hit. And it was a thing, but you couldn't really sell it because nobody would believe it. It was weird. So we saw the GPT-3.5 stuff hit. And then we saw that first week. And then I was still a little bit of a pessimist, I'll be honest. And around Christmas, like the week of Christmas, Dan Katz called and was like, dude, I think we should try it, right? Like we've tried all these other tests and exams and formal assessments from the natural language processing community. He was like, just try it, right? It won't take that long. Just hack it out in a day or two. It's quiet this week. No client work over Christmas week or whatever. And so I did it. And it was so much better than any prior models, I think, which didn't mean passing clearly in the case of 3.5, Text DaVinci 3. But it meant that it was within a clear path to being able to pass, whether that's through combining it with other sources of knowledge, through like retrieval augmentation, which is kind of what a lot of the information providers do. Like everybody's seen CoCounsel. So that's like kind of how that stuff works. Or whether it's just through these base models, like the thing that you actually get from OpenAI or Microsoft, knowing, in quotes, about legal. And then I guess, again, under NDA about some of this stuff. But then we started working with Pablo and Shang, one of the other engineers at Case Text, on the GPT-4 version of the paper. And Pablo was, he said this himself publicly too, right? Pablo was never really in doubt that this thing was going to pass based on what he'd seen already. Yeah. And as he said, like what the reaction that many managing partners at firms had had to what they had seen too on the screen. So it was more of an exercise in terms of like putting this all together. And there's a lot of the stuff that went into this, both from a what can we do with commercial restriction perspectives, what can we do because it's got to be totally behind the scenes prior to GPT-4 being publicly announced, and what can we do because the NCBE and the state bars don't make a bunch of this stuff actually public and available in kind of an official format. So it was a long, crazy, fun road at the end of the day to basically have a lot of people nod their head and not be very surprised because they had all kind of used ChatGPT or seen GPT-4 and weren't surprised by the time it was all said and done. So that was one of the most fascinating things. I know I've been mumbling for like 5 minutes straight here, but by the time we did all of this, nobody cared when we launched the GPT-4 thing because nobody was surprised. When we talked to like managing partners or GCs or whoever, nobody cared. Even the NCBE who we had talked with wasn't surprised when we published that paper. It was like a non-issue to people and they all moved on, and it's just like in the zeitgeist now, and we'll talk to people and they don't even know we're authors of the paper, and it's kind of funny, and honestly I'm happy about that because it makes the conversation a lot easier. Just nod my head and move on, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's like on Jeopardy when
Watson
you know, beat
OG Watson, though, not Watson X.AI, which
let's be clear. You know, people were just kind of, you know, they were very surprised, and they were just like, wow, that's amazing. And you know, so, and even you were saying, you know, you weren't quite a believer for GPT-3. And, you know, you've talked about others' expectations for GPT-4. And, you know, and it seems that, you know, in the past we've kind of been, you know, we've been a little skeptical of different new technologies. But, you know, now it just seems, like you said, well, no one was surprised at this point because they've all been using it, you know. But what were your expectations, you know, going in? What did you think of the results? And, you know, why do you think suddenly, like, everybody's like, okay, that's okay now? You know, it's like, of course it did well, you know?
Yeah. I mean, again, I'll kind of borrow a Pablo anecdote. You just sit down and there's some area of law or some work product that you have personally experienced, and you ask it, especially in a retrieval augmented context, like the information providers are able to put together when they combine it with primary law, you ask it to draft a motion or a contract or a demand letter with some specifics to it. And in less time than it takes you or takes the managing partner to email the associate, it's got a response on the screen that's pretty darn good. That's probably better than your first year or second year or maybe even your third year. And then you say, okay, any veil that had stood between belief and me is now gone, which is funny because I've been using neural networks in one form or another for 20-ish years. I like wrote a feed forward network in C and Fortran once upon a time. So it's like, this is not none of this stuff is technically new to me,
right?
But to see it on the screen, like the moment when Pablo showed it to me the first time, was when all of the theory and math and conjecture became just, I guess, the state of the world today.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that, and we've had other guests that mentioned this, it may have been Pablo himself, is that not only did the GPT-4 pass the bar exam, but it did it in something like 7 minutes. Does that sound about
that
right?
That was the MBE. Yeah,
the MBE,
so he's probably quoting the MBE portion. And GPT-3.5 is different, like TextDaVinci 3 is different than Turbo Boost 3.5 is different than 4.8K is different than... there's a bunch of caveats to some of that. So the point is, depending on the day and how many people are trying to use ChatGPT, the thing can do it in under 5 minutes. If everybody's trying to do their homework, then it's all going to crash and the API will return errors and you won't pass the exam. But but somewhere in there, we have a bunch of data that shows that the thing could pass every, like, answer all 200-some MBE questions, including the experimental ones, in under whatever number of seconds. And according to the latest jdadvising.com table, take it with a grain of salt or whatever, at a 97th percentile national average.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, well, that was never a good assessment of the real practice of law anyway, so what's next?
Yeah, that's, well, and let me expound upon that then. What do you think, are there any other I know that you said now everyone's just kind of, it's not a big deal, but you still see that and you hear it. It's hard to hear a podcast or read an article that somewhere in it doesn't say, you know, this thing passed in the, you know, the top 10%, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Percent or percentile or whatever,
yeah,
right?
The 90th percentile.
Colbert can't get it right.
And so, I mean, it's definitely a, you know, it's a line that's being used to show how far advanced this has gotten. I would say, are there any other types of exams that it could be taking to show, or do you think now it's time it's going to start writing the exams? So,
it'll figure out a better way to test people on you know, their actual knowledge in terms of being practitioners. You know, we can ask that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how deep you want to go, right? But it's like, I think it has revealed to us, to some degree, the chance that there was a fleeting moment in time when knowledge work looked like this. Because if we're being honest, there's a lot of what we do as, quote, knowledge workers that isn't really a lot of knowledge. And so is tacit experience, is strategy, is the ability to understand in a very deep way whoever you're representing or their opposing counsel or counterparties or the environment in which they operate. Is that what you're doing? Or is it simply that you know which sections of the IRC turn into a decision tree that you can then turn into yes, this applies, or no, it doesn't? Like, the latter doesn't seem like something humans like doing. My wife's a CPA, CIPP, Big Four, right? Like, that's part of why we did the CPA exam. I can tell you for a fact, even people who go to school and get all these degrees and work in Big Four don't really like doing a lot of that kind of knowledge work. It's not much different for most attorneys, right? I mean, what is it that we're doing as knowledge workers today isn't necessarily what we want to do or should be doing or can sustainably do from an economic perspective. And boy, has this thing put all that stuff front and center.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about some of the other work that you are doing, which includes the 273 Ventures and another, and I guess this is part of that with the Kelvin Legal.
Yeah, it's a geeky thing, right? And like talking to a guy who's got some of the coolest comic books around, right? It's like I feel safe. But the 273 and Kelvin stuff is all an allusion to like chaos and order and entropy, and in really, in a deep sense, the problem that we all are knowledge or information engineers in this field. Obviously, there's the strategic stuff, but much of what we do from an effort hour perspective is engineering around information. Like, I want to change the days to pay from 30 to 90, or I want to change an assignment restriction or insert an assignment restriction as forms of information or knowledge or whatever. and we just push bits of knowledge around. Why is there so much chaos when what we really are is knowledge and information managers? Why do our systems, why are our processes so ridden with chaos? Why is it that the marginal cost of drafting the next contract, of doing the next asset purchase agreement, right? Of even basic things like billing the same client with the same timekeepers the next month on doing roughly the same thing. Why is it so chaotic? Why are the marginal costs so high? So Kelvin and 273 are all about this like absolute zero from a physics or thermodynamics perspective, where for better or worse, down there you get some degree of order. You don't have this kind of entropy or chaos, and the marginal cost in some sense goes to absolute zero. So Kelvin is about turning the things that we do, which is not everything, but the things that we do in this profession that are information or knowledge engineering into low marginal cost propositions.
And what about 273 Ventures?
Yeah. So that is, we started out, so we had Lex Predict. We founded it in 14. We exited in 18. We sold it to Elevate, an ALSP outsourcing company. We did 3 years, whatever, you know, the story with this stuff. And then last year we came out, an incredible time, right, to start fresh with clean slate, and all the LLM stuff hit. And so we started with this 273 brand with that kind of the metaphor that I mentioned a minute ago, and then searched around for a little bit of a metaphor that we liked with this chaos and entropy stuff. And that's where this Kelvin thing came from. So 273 Ventures is the entity, and Kelvin is the brand that we're going to market with in terms of the what we're calling a legal data operating system, which is just a really fancy way of saying like a data stack or a data warehouse or a knowledge management platform.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was looking over the website and thanks to you right before we got on, you showed me some additional examples and some use cases of what you're looking at. And you got things like automating litigation workflow, looking at the billing analytics. And so, I mean, is this, for lack of a better way of saying it, is this just automation of certain tasks that humans do now? Is that what your efforts are, or is it something beyond that?
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's easy to get very overwhelmed very quickly from like a single point sale or point solution. So what we're building is a bunch of what we think of as Lego blocks, or the pieces from a software or data or quote AI perspective that you need to do just about everything that can be automated. So we started from the foundation. It's really boring stuff at the bottom, right? It's like moving data around between deal rooms in OneDrive. It's OCRing documents when the words that appear in legal documents are not like the words that Adobe expects. It's spell checking, the same kind of thing, right? Your dictionary in Word doesn't know most of the words we use. It's a problem. When you let an AI model go to town on a bunch of text that's come through a bad OCR process that has been spell corrected in the wrong way, then you get bad outputs. And so whether you're going to do some fancy AI stuff or not, you got to start with the foundation. And the foundation for documents is typically, are the words on the page the words they need to be if it came through a digital or scan process? So, and then there's a bunch of fancier stuff, right? Like we plug into all the different AI models. We have all these kind of vector database things. And that's how, for example, Casetax can combine the primary law, which is many more tokens than fits in GPT-3 or 4 or any large language model, with your query to get back the relevant portions of case law or statutory or regulatory material to answer your question. So there's a bunch of this really boring kind of technical stuff at the bottom. And yes, for most firms, that's not what they're going to buy, right? Like maybe the Am Law 10 or Magic Circle firms or Fortune 50 have legal departments with data scientists who know how to use that stuff. But the use case section, which I think you're alluding to and I had put in that chat, is what the end goal of that stuff is. So you with us, you essentially buy these Lego blocks and you can make them into anything, right? Mm-hmm. You can turn them into any of these use cases. And instead of buying 5 or 10 different point solutions that are SaaS solutions that may or may not, as we're seeing today, go through business combinations and get repriced, or not get their Series A or B or C and continue viably or whatever, right? So like, instead of being beholden to all of the vendor counterparty risk that buying point solutions creates, you can kind of buy, if you're ready for it from a maturity perspective, you can buy one platform with all the tools you need and have all 5 or 10 of those point solutions. And another differentiator for us is that we're old school. All of our stuff you can license, and you get the source code and escrow, and you could put it on your own servers, physical or VMware cluster. Like, had an hour and a half call earlier today with a MLaw 1025 firm, right? And they're all focused on how do we get this stuff on our VMware cluster, because we really want to use large language models, but we're not going to send any of these documents up to GPT.
Yeah.
So what can we do?
Yeah. And I think you're seeing a lot of the topics right now, especially if you have Casetext CoCounsel, you have Harvey.ai, that really talk about applying generative AI to the practice of law. But it, you know, looking at the list you have, and I'll make sure that I put a link on the show notes to the list, this is more on the operations and the business side of law. And I think we may not be as far on that curve on the operation side with generative AI as we are on the practice side at this moment. Maybe not. Marlene's kind of giving me a little side eye on that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just sort of thinking about, like, you know, Microsoft and Copilot, and I think that there's talk about sort of the operative type of capabilities for that product.
Like the syntax demo yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what I want to see, and I think I saw it kind of on that list, is an easy way to take, you know, the taxonomies or, you know, the metadata from a product, you know, an open source product like Sally, and have that more automated on our side. I know there's a lot of talk about it, but I want to see, I for one want to see a little bit more action going forward on.
Yeah, I know, and that's where it's like the we all have the same dream or vision about future state, right? And obviously there's all the commercials and trust issues to get there, but why do we not have more interoperability of data, whether it's between vendors or between firms or the corporate from a pooling perspective? It doesn't really help anyone to hoard privately the vast majority of what we hoard privately. And so the only way to really do so many of the things that we've talked about, I mean, you've been talking about for decades, right, is to share at least a taxonomy. I'm not saying I'm not saying these two firms have to merge, although there's clearly going to be a lot of that this year, but can we at least agree on what the areas of law and practice groups are? So some of the boring examples of stuff we're doing are, I mean, this is incredibly boring, but a good example of it's not substantive, it's low hanging fruit, it would help, it's a real thing. We're going through law firm directories for personnel and trying to help them standardize the areas of law or practice groups or how they refer to languages or where they're admitted, so that all of that stuff is tagged, yes, with Sally. Thank you to Damien and Toby and Jim Hannigan for doing all the hard work to put all the tags in one place that we can consume them. But we're tagging all of those law firm profiles that we all know and love with standards that then mean the law firm can send to the corporate in the RFP a standards-based digest of who their actual experts are, so the corporate can consume in batch all those experts. And it's not like a bad thing, because the next time, with the tools at least, right, the next time the firm has an issue and wants to say, out of our panel, who should we call? All that standardized data means they might have a system where your name is going to show up at the firm, right? And you'll get that call, if only the corporate had a way to reliably search across different firms for the industry or matter type or whatever it is that they're trying to narrow in on. So it's a lot of the boring stuff, right? It doesn't have to be drafting a motion that's going to determine whether or not a business continues as a going concern. It could just be fixing all of our data in these systems we rely on. And I think that gets lost in a lot of the conversations about generative AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're talking a little bit about like what we can do with Kelvin's AI. So how does the capabilities, how does that differentiate it? Because, you know, I'm hearing some of the things you're talking about. And it's like, okay, I've heard that from some of the other sources too. It's like, you know, so how is this differentiated from the other solutions in the legal industry?
It's an interesting question because it's like, to some degree, we're not differentiated other than that we do all of this stuff kind of under one mm-hmm. platform. Mm-hmm. So instead of
buying five or ten point solutions. Which is also a little bit different. It's not like, oh, hey, here's this big thing and you can do whatever you want with it. It's like, here's like, you know, this chunk.
Yep. So we have like, I mean, you want to talk buyer persona and everything. Law firms tend to be buyers of urgency of point solutions. And so they buy one module here. They buy the NLP module. They buy the billing module. They've got an urgent matter or transaction. They buy the source module. They end up spending more and would have been better off developing the capability up front. And Greg, you've been talking about this for a while, to put it lightly. So the corporates might be more strategic buyers who invest in larger scale synergistic capabilities, but then they also have different time scales and their own set of problems
budgets
too. So it's a weird market, right? We all live this market, so we all know the pain points, but it's like, and a lot of it does come back to shared data, right? So like having fewer data migration or data quality issues would, I think, facilitate less hesitance, because we've all been through the prior generations of AI, the prior promises of the next gen ELM that fell flat on its face. And a lot of it comes back to data, right? The quality of the data, the taxonomies, the degree to which you agree with the taxonomy. So,
well, and I think there's kind of a secret hope that the AI will just fix all of the crazy stuff we've done for 30 years.
It'll fix enterprise search.
I don't think it's
search.
That smart yet.
It'll fix enterprise search.
There we go. Yeah.
I want to be both optimistic but realistic, but also not underestimate what's possible. It's like, if you really wanted to sign up for something like the SALI standard, well, I do think you could do, for example, as we are kind of doing right now, an ELM or a practice taxonomy update where you go through every single matter in Foundation or Elite or Team Connect or whatever, and update every single one of those matter areas or sub areas or whatever. And as long as you're okay with the SALI standard, I think we do kind of have that dream today. Now, there's obviously a lot of people who are going to want something different than what's in the legal matter standard specification today. There's specialized practice areas. It's a lot of stuff you could talk about. And I don't know if you've had Damian Real or anybody else from SALI on, but recently at least. But there's a lot of stuff in the pipeline right now. So on the GitHub for the LMSS standard, we got a lot of stuff in the pipeline. And hopefully some of that will get people jazzed up. Hopefully I'll find some more time to help get that over the line too. But the like this weekend, if all goes well. But the Damian's listening, I'm sure, so I got to say that. The hope is still a valid hope. And I think there's more. The flame has been kindled more in the last 6 months than it deserved to have been kindled in the last 6 years.
Yep.
So let's not snuff it out yet.
No, I agree. So if you could give, say, one piece of advice for law firms out there who are still trying to wrap their heads around the potential for these generative AI tools and LLMs, you know, what would you tell them?
Can you say it on
one
the air?
Because we do. I mean, we talk with managing partners or the innovation committees or councils or whatever name is ascribed to the one or more individuals who
emerging
are
technologies
responsible.
Is ours. Yeah.
and then there's like 17 task force variants that are all with overlapping scope, and it feels like the federal government by the time we're done. But the reality is, I don't think there's any way out of this other than being honest about delivery and value proposition. And again, I know everybody's been saying this for longer than anybody wants to admit, and it's been wrong every year over and over again, but I do think that the corporates, from just an awareness perspective over the next 12 to 36 months, are not going to let this be the moment, especially in light of like rising interest rates, the potential for a little bit of economic dislocation from other issues abroad and domestic. So I just don't think this is going to be the one. People always talk about, like, I spend a lot of time in finance and alternative investments. You can short a stock or short a market like real estate, mortgage-backed securities, residential, for a very long time and be right about the fact that residential mortgage-backed securities will eventually experience a dramatic destruction in value. But being wrong for 7 years is tough. And so I don't know. This is where, as a betting man, I don't know what I'd say, but I do think this is the year, right? Mm-hmm. Or the next 2 to 3 years.
Feels like it.
When the AFAs are going to have to be an honest thing, not just like a shadow billing of hourly time and you still give it to the guy you went to school with, but like, what value are you creating? What risk are you reducing? How are we seriously going to measure all of that? And I'm okay compensating you in a way that gives you a material part of the value you create or the risk you reduce, but we all got to be honest with each other. And so in some sense, it just starts with that honesty. And if it has to be Chatham House rules at Chatham rules at some private forums, then so be it. And that is happening to some degree, but it's got to happen. It's got to happen fast, because the thing is, we all are friends to some degree, the GCs and the managing partners, but the CFO is not necessarily your friend. CEO is not the friend. The shareholders are not your friends. And they know you're not going to put this genie back in the bottle.
Michael, we have reached the end of the podcast. And at this point, we ask all of the guests the crystal ball question. And that is, what changes or challenges do you see for the industry over the next 2 to 5 years?
I'll focus on one that I feel is, let's say, normatively most important. I feel like we need to get out ahead of the education elephant, right? We need to be at the highest level possible, at the schools on the ground, figuring out what we're telling the students who are coming into these next cohorts, and making sure that what's actually available to them, whether it's in-house or not, is a truthful representation of the things that we think, right? Like, I think there's this sense, if you will, of a detrimental reliance of all these cohorts going in. And I don't think we are all going to look back in 5 years and feel good about not being honest with the students who are coming into the system right now, in light of the things that we're seeing in terms of delayed associate onboarding or total associates required or just overall demand. So that, to me, is the biggest thing. And we could talk, obviously, shop about technology or AI, but from a what's nagging me in my heart perspective, it's I don't want a student deciding to go to school under a set of assumptions that we all know they should know better.
Yeah, are we preparing them and informing them adequately?
Yeah, right. Detrimental reliance aside, in the tort sense or whatever, it's like, we need to make sure that the curriculum that we put them through, that they pay for, reflects what we actually need them from an industry perspective to be doing when they come out. It's always been an issue to some degree, but it is going to be more of an issue over the next 3 to 5 years than I think it has ever been before.
What a unique perspective on legal education.
Yeah, I can say that because I'm not tenured faculty and I'm not a managing partner at a firm. So I, again, have this my crystal ball is not clouded by any of that.
All right. Well, Michael Bomarito, CEO of 273 Ventures, thank you very much for hopping on the call with us. This has been great.
Thank you all.
And of course, thanks to all of you, our listeners, for taking the time to listen to the Geek and Review podcast. If you enjoyed the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeBauerM on Twitter.
And I can be reached at Glambert on Twitter. Mike, if someone wanted to reach out or learn more, where can you be found online?
I embarrassingly am not very active online anymore, but I am on LinkedIn, given the age and all, and on Twitter at MJBOMMAR.
All right. Professionals of a certain age are on LinkedIn.
I know. I was like trying not to laugh.
Still or whatever.
And speaking of professionals at a certain age, listeners, you can also leave us a voicemail on our Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Monica. Thank you, Jerry.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, have a happy holiday.
All right. You as well.